From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's sports show, Only a Game. Last week, we thought we'd finally said goodbye to Deflategate, but wait, there's more. Ahead on Only a Game, ESPN reporters Don Van Natta and Seth Wickersham throw some investigative fuel on the fire. Also, a former professional cheerleader makes the case for fair wages. American soccer star Landon Donovan reflects on his career. And a young man from Sierra Leone brings Ebola survivors to the soccer pitch for some fun and camaraderie. Also ahead, AFC Bournemouth, the little football club that could, makes not one, not two, but three odds-defying leaps and lands in the English Premiership.
Now, I think I've had to pinch myself, you know, a few times. Somehow, we did achieve the impossible. Somehow, the journey has ended at the very top level of English football.
Stay tuned. 8 years ago, NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell punished the New England Patriots for filming the signals of opposing coaches during games, a scandal that became known as Spygate. In May, Goodell handed a four-game suspension to Patriots quarterback Tom Brady for his alleged role in the Deflategate scandal. The suspension has since been nullified, though the Patriots did pay a $1 million fine and they forfeited two draft picks. In a story for ESPN, the magazine, Don Van Natta Jr. and Seth Wickersham contend there's a connection between Goodell's handling of those two scandals. Don, would you explain, please?
Well, we started reporting this story back in May, and very early on, Seth and I were hearing from league owners, people around the league, executives, that people were pleased with the way Deflategate was going. People said this was a makeup call for Spygate, behavior that was far more serious than a little air let out of footballs. We decided to look at the two investigations forensically, carefully, and that's what we did in this piece.
One of the criticisms is that Commissioner Goodell wrapped up the Spygate investigation much too quickly. Seth, why? Why was it wrapped up so quickly?
It's a great mystery. I don't know if he did it because he didn't want to know. And this was his first crisis as a commissioner. And I think he just wanted it swept under the rug as quickly as possible. And contrast that with this Deflategate investigation, which was outsourced last month, cost millions of dollars. They interviewed 66 people. It's quite a bit different.
Don, your investigation also turned up some troubling details beyond the taping, allegations that the Patriots stole play sheets before games from the opposing locker room, that they jammed opponents' radio signals before critical plays. What are you hoping readers will take away from this story beyond an appreciation of those specific offenses?
Well, that information is really important to understand the context. We had members of the competition committee in the NFL tell us that basically from 2001 to 2007, most of the complaints they got were about the Patriots. It just shows the sort of level of paranoia, anger, resentment, and the anger in particular was directed at the league office and Roger Goodell and the way this investigation was wrapped up so quickly.
You talk about the level of paranoia about the Patriots, but there's another kind of paranoia evident in your article, I think, and it's Roger Goodell's paranoia about interference in the league, specifically by Congress. He says Congress could ruin the league if there were an investigation. What's he afraid of?
Well, that's a good point, Bill. Arlen Specter, the late senator from Pennsylvania, was quite angry at the way the NFL conducted its Spygate investigation. And he was calling for a thorough investigation by Congress where Congress would bring everybody on Capitol Hill, including the commissioner, to testify under oath. And if you lie to Congress, that's a federal offense.
But I'm curious here. What were they afraid that an investigation was going to reveal?
Well, it could have revealed all sorts of things that actually our story revealed. Exactly what would have been found out, Bill, I don't know. I just know that congressional investigations are not things that Roger Goodell and the NFL usually like.
Seth, the Patriots released a statement in response to your story. What did they say, and did it surprise you?
Well, there was a perception that the Patriots had taped a walkthrough shortly before they played the Rams in the Super Bowl that kind of started their run under Bill Belichick. The Patriots are obviously very sensitive to the idea that a Super Bowl was ever compromised, and their statement basically said, we didn't tape the walkthrough, we never did.
Yeah, and by the way, Bill, let me just say, we never allege in our story that the Patriots taped that walkthrough. We sent the Patriots 24 questions 8 days before our story was published. They only chose to deal with a handful of those questions on the record, and most of them they chose not to answer.
Roger Goodell seems to have lost one of his biggest supporters among the owners. That would be Patriots owner Robert Kraft. Goodell's contract expires in 2019. Do you think he makes it to the end of his term?
I'm not sure. Goodell is 0-5 in appeals of his disciplinary matters. The Ray Rice debacle last fall created a lot of negative headlines for the league. But the metric that's most important for Roger Goodell is revenues. And the revenues keep growing, and Goodell has set the goal, if you will, of $25 billion in annual revenues by 2027. The league is, I believe, going to hit that mark, and that's the standard that most owners judge Roger Goodell by.
All right, I have to ask you guys one more question. Many people were relieved when a federal judge finally ruled on Brady's suspension last week because it meant just maybe we could finally stop talking about Deflategate. And then your article comes out. Goodness, do you feel bad about this at all?
No, because I feel like that football fans in Boston and elsewhere have spent the entire offseason wondering why one of the game's greatest ambassadors was being smeared because some air might have been let out of footballs. And I think that we set out to answer that question as best we can.
Certainly, I know the story is not very popular in New England, but you know, there's nothing more important, I would hope, to NFL fans than the competitive integrity of the football games that we all watch every Sunday. And this story goes to the heart of that and shows how this commissioner weighed that.
Don Van Natta Jr. and Seth Wickersham are senior writers for ESPN. You can link to their story, Spygate to Deflategate, Inside What Split the NFL and the Patriots Apart, at onlyagame.org. Don and Seth, thank you both very much for speaking with me.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Bill.
It's well known that universities, which are home to the most profitable college football teams, often depend on those teams to subsidize much of the rest of the athletic program. But it may surprise even the most passionate fans that those teams operate as profit centers separate from the schools they represent. Gilbert Gaul, the author of Billion Dollar Ball, subtitled A Journey Through the Big Money Culture of College Football, joins me now. Mr. Gaul, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you for having me on the show.
I'd like to start with you helping us understand why the programs at the universities most committed to football are so expensive. Alabama, for example, spends more than $40 million a year on its program. That's more than double what it spent in 2007 when head coach Nick Saban arrived.
It's just very expensive. The amount of money going to head coach salaries in college football at the elite level is just extraordinary. Saban, again, not to pick on him or Alabama, $7.1 million in 2014. The top 10 coaches in college football at elite schools are averaging about $5 million in salary a year. And then, of course, they have 9 full-time assistants. And their salaries have all gone through the roof as well. Then you have the spending on facilities. You have all the back office operations, which have grown, the number of employees and athletic departments. So it's one thing after another.
You mentioned facilities, not only stadiums and weight rooms, but academic support programs. Tell us about the one at the University of Oregon.
These things, the academic support programs, are relatively recent phenomena. By that, I mean within the last couple of decades. Instead of just, you know, maybe a tutor or two, you have this incredible and elaborate and really expensive operation with maybe 100 tutors, with academic advisors, with psychologists, with life skill coaches. And at Oregon, the center, this $42 million center, is incredibly lavish. I went to visit it, spent a day there. It looks like a museum of modern art. There's a gaslit fire. There's a fire pit in the lobby. It's the most extraordinary thing you've ever seen. It's exclusive to the athletes, other than a coffee bar on the first floor. Mm. And so then I went and looked at the Honors College at Oregon. The building is a 77-year-old building built during the WPA in the Great Depression. The elevator didn't work. There was no interior staircase to get up to the second floor. They had 1.5 classroom buildings that they could use for the students.
You compare what has been described as the college football arms race to the housing bubble or the dot-com bubble, both of which, of course, eventually burst. Tell us a little bit about this arms race and whether you think the ever more expensive enterprise of college football will eventually burst.
just Texas alone, I think there were five schools that spent, during the period I looked at them, $1 billion on new stadiums. So the idea is that you have to have this in order to make the business model work. What I'm curious about is all of this going to stay the way it is, or is it going to change? And I'm interested in the notion of the disruptive effects of technology, you know, whether the younger generation of students and fans is as interested in college football as their parents and grandparents were. And the short answer is, I don't think so. I mean, we've begun to see some indications where students are leaving games at halftime or they're not showing up at games. So I think, you know, looking down a decade or so out, I think there are a few signs that it's not going to collapse, but this kind of monster we see as college football now, you know, it might be affected by some of these things and maybe not be quite as big.
Did any of the coaches, athletic directors, college presidents, or chancellors with whom you spoke offer an alternative to the system you describe in Billion Dollar Ball?
No, because they think that this business model is a great business model. They're bringing in money that can help pay for the so-called poor sports that really don't have any revenue. So, you know, the athletic directors, basically, they're happy with what they have for the most part because the model's working. It's ginning up all of this money. And, of course, their salaries have gone up as well.
Well, it's a successful model at the schools where the football team is very successful and has a gigantic and wealthy fan base, but it's a mug's game for almost everybody else, I think.
Yeah, I think so as well. I looked at and visited a number of these schools because I was interested in this basic question, well, why do you play football? And I went to Akron, for example, and Akron has struggled since 2000. Its record is 64-114, yet they built a $60 million football stadium. They were paying their football coach $500,000 a year. The model didn't seem to work. When I spoke with the president, he told me, well, you know, we think we're going to win at some point in time. And by the way, this is the only thing that we have on campus where I can get a large number of people to pay attention to. You know, since then, Akron has announced a $60 million hole in its university finances. It's laying off 213 people. It eliminated the baseball program. But do you think they took anything out of football? And the answer is no.
Gilbert Gall, twice a Pulitzer Prize winner, is the author of Billion Dollar Ball, A Journey Through the Big Money Culture of College Football. Gilbert, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Well, thank you for having me on. It's been great.
It's time now for the three stories you should know, at least according to me and my two guests. And this week, they are Andrea Kramer, correspondent for HBO's Real Sports and the NFL Network, and Will Leach of Sports on Earth. Welcome back, both of you.
Hello, Bill. Nice to see you.
Happy to be back on.
Impolite as it may seem, I'm going to start with me. On Friday, John Calipari, currently coaching the men's basketball team at Kentucky, was inducted into the Basketball Hall of Fame. Coach Calipari used to run the program at Memphis, and so the president of the university with which the basketball team there is vaguely affiliated proposed to honor Coach Cal with a dinner. No! Shouted many Memphis fans as one. They hadn't forgotten that Calipari's achievements at Memphis had been nullified. He used ineligible players. Then he left the program for a better job just as the NCAA was about to sanction Memphis, and then he took his recruits with him to Kentucky. So John Calipari, headed for the Hall of Fame because he is, in fact, famous. He's also the embodiment of college basketball's hypocrisy. And I say three cheers for the Memphis fans who haven't forgotten that. I'm glad they pressured the president to back down. Will, are you with me?
I'm with you on the Memphis part. I have to say, though, I ultimately think that the world has actually come around to Calipari for the worse. I'm not saying that he's made the world a better place, but like a lot of things that Calipari did 10 years ago that we couldn't believe he was doing, now a lot of coaches kind of openly discuss. The reason Calipari has succeeded is because he understood in a way, the way college basketball was going. Maybe not the way we wanted it to go, but I think 10 years later, it's easy to see that it has gone that way.
You know what? I actually have a totally different take on this, and that is that regardless of the sport, I don't feel that active head coaches should be inducted into a Hall of Fame. I mean, look, Calipari, maybe he has come around, but he has a history. So I ask you, whether you're Calipari, whether you're Jim Boeheim, who's in the Hall of Fame as well, What if there is a major transgression? What are they going to do? Take you out? Are they going to vote you out?
You don't even have to wait for the major transgressions for Calipari. And I'm not even talking about the fact that he recruits kids who he knows are not students and he knows they're not going to be there more than 6 months because they're going to go to the NBA or go play basketball in Europe. I didn't even bring that up because everybody's doing that. I'm talking about the nullifications and I'm talking about leaving programs in the lurch.
I certainly understand why Memphis doesn't like him. I'll put it that way.
That's the easy part. All right, Will, I understand that when at least one feature of old-timey baseball resurfaced this week, you found reason to rejoice. So explain, please.
All right, so on Wednesday night, Joey Votto, the player for the Cincinnati Reds, had enough troubles with the umpire that he flipped out. And he started screaming and yelling and getting in the umpire's face. He almost, you expect him to pick up dirt and throw it on his shoe. And it was, it felt like this weird throwback that was charming in a way, because, you know, now in the age of replay, yelling at the umpire seems like kind of getting upset at the copy machine or something. this is a middle manager guy that eventually, like, the manager goes to the top step of the dugout, looks up, calls his video guy, and then trots out and says, "We want a formal review." That's no fun. I miss when we yelled at umpires. Votto was out of line, but very entertainingly in throwback out of line, I thought.
Andrea, should contemporary baseball include reminders of the glory days of Earl Weaver, Leo DeRocher at all?
Yeah, I mean, you're waiting for Bobby Knight to throw a chair or something like that. But, you know,
I shouldn't laugh. That wasn't funny.
I'm sorry. But, you know, the game does seem so sanitized sometimes. I mean, look, you know, back to the NFL. I'm sorry about this. But you score a point. But wait, hold on. Don't cheer because we have to go to replay and make sure that it's good. I mean, at some point, these are all games where human nature is supposed to come into play. Judgment is supposed to come into play. Umpires have the experience, the intellect to judge these things, but human error is all part of it, and I do like Joey Votto's reaction.
I'm going to have to disagree, just for the reason that baseball games are already far too long. Arguments that we already know the outcome, they make the games even longer. I'd rather watch baseball than guys shouting at each other and kicking dirt on each other's shoes, so, you know.
But every now and then...
Okay, Andrea, I understand your story is something on the lighter side.
I'm usually the one who's, let's talk about domestic violence and let's talk about this social issue and that. So I want to digress just for one quick second. I grew up loving sports. It's been my passion my entire life. But then you grow up and you work in the business and you realize no cheering in the press box. And what you realize is that, hey, you have to be an objective journalist. But this week, I got to dispense with that very briefly. At the U.S. Open, I got to see the player who is my favorite in all of the sport, the absolutely magical Roger Federer. It was just so wonderful to see him, and it was really rare for me to just go back and enjoy sports from a fan's point of view.
Well, for what it's worth, I'm bad at many things, but one thing I'm very bad at is being an impartial sports reporter. You know, frankly, one of the reasons that Deadspin was founded in the first place, because I had been in that press box, and I felt so straitjacketed. I didn't cheer. I was a professional, but boy, did I want to, and it felt like I was almost getting the enjoyment of the game legislated out of me. Mm-hmm. So for me, I wanted to make sure to be able to write about sports in a way that allowed me to still be a fan. Certainly, there are a lot of very serious issues in sports, but it is still an escape. It is still a diversion in many ways. And I always try to remember, even while I still try to cover the serious things in sports and write about those, that this is supposed to be fun.
My guests for this week's Three Stories You Should Know have been Andrea Kramer, correspondent for HBO's Real Sports and for the NFL Network, and Will Leach of Sports on Earth. Thank you very much to both of you.
Oh, it's great to talk to you. Thanks so much for having us on, Bill.
The English Premier League has been underway for a few weeks now. This season, Manchester United, Chelsea, Arsenal, Liverpool, and others have been joined by AFC Bournemouth. Bournemouth's rise to English soccer's elite has been sudden and swift. To find out more, we turn to journalist and lifelong AFC Bournemouth fan, Russell Crewe.
Now, it's not often you get to start a sports report on the beach, but this is Bournemouth, a town and a football club unlike any other in the English Premier League. While most EPL clubs are located in large, gritty urban centres, Bournemouth is the only one which can be found in a seaside resort.
Well, it's a beautiful part of the world along this coastline. Lovely sandy beaches.
Well, funnily enough, I actually had two American guests here a few days ago and they described it very much like California, but a bit smaller.
Having lovely weather, 7 miles of sand and a more relaxed pace of life is probably the smallest difference between Bournemouth and the rest of the EPL. To find out more, I met with Michael Dunn, presenter of the All Departments podcast. It's the only podcast dedicated to following AFC Bournemouth, and we started by measuring crowd numbers.
We've got a stadium which holds about 12,500. It'll be full for every single game. Biggest ground in the Premier League is Manchester United. That's about 75,000. Arsenal have got 60,000. Newcastle, I think it's around 50, 55. We're a very small club.
The huge difference in ground sizes will certainly be an eye-opener for players such as Wayne Rooney and Diego Costa. And they'll have an even bigger shock when they discover just how much cheaper it was to build Bournemouth's squad of players. Manchester City bought Raheem Sterling for $75 million this summer, while Bournemouth's starting 11 cost around $60 million in total. Making it to the Premier League and competing against the world's biggest clubs and players has suddenly made AFC Bournemouth a global brand. Until recently, this football club would be lucky if just one of their games appeared on live television in the UK. Now, every one of their matches are shown in 140 countries. So for many outsiders, it's hard to understand that just 7 short years ago, this club was on the brink of extinction. But Michael Dunn remembers it clearly.
For most of my supporting life, we've been the poster child for how not to run a football club. There's been 2 or 3 occasions when we've come very close to going out of business. The turnaround in the club's fortunes has been something that no fan would expect.
AFC Bournemouth's home ground is known by locals as Dean Court, but to the new sponsors as the Vitality Stadium. And it was there, in the air-conditioned inner sanctum of the owner's box, where I met Bournemouth chairman Jeff Mostyn. Back in 2008, AFC Bournemouth were playing in the fourth tier of English professional soccer. As a business, the club was financially bust, and the chairman put in some of his own money to save it. I wondered if Jeff ever thought he'd get that cash back.
Never in a million years. I still, even to this day, don't know why I invested it. I'm embarrassed to say I'm a financial advisor.
Despite Jeff's actions, the soccer authorities punished the club for their financial failings. Out of 92 teams, the Bournemouth squad started the 2008-2009 season in 91st place. They faced a fight. It was a fight for their survival, both as a soccer team and as a business.
The years of adversity created an incredible tenacity. We felt that the whole sporting world were against us.
Their fight didn't start well, and within 4 months, the club had sacked 2 managers. In desperation, they turned to a locally born ex-player and former fans' favourite, Eddie Howe. Just 31 years old, it was his first ever job managing a professional side, and in just a few months, he achieved the seemingly impossible, saving the club from relegation and certain doom. The following season, almost as if all the bad things hadn't happened, he led his team to promotion, taking them from the fourth to the third tier of English football. Here's Michael Dunn again.
We've got a manager here, Eddie Howe, who seems to be able to get an awful lot out of his players.
Although briefly poached to manage another club, Howe returned and immediately took those players from the third tier to the Championship, England's second division. No one dreamed they could earn promotion again, but in the Championship, Eddie Howe remained true to his football philosophy and continued to rely on many of the players who had risen up through the English soccer leagues with him. And it was that cohesiveness which saw Bournemouth achieve the unthinkable. As the final whistle blew on the penultimate fixture of last season, fans poured onto the pitch. AFC Bournemouth had won the championship and with it gained promotion to the Premier League. Although recent investment by a Russian owner has played some part in their rise, the club still had to fight against the odds. The past 7 years have been like a dream for the club, the players, the town, and fans like me. I wondered if the chairman, Jeff Mostyn, ever worried he might wake up and discover it hadn't really happened.
Now, I think I've had to pinch myself, you know, a few times. Somehow, we did achieve the impossible. Somehow, the journey has ended at the very top level of English football.
Wherever the team finish this season, it will be the highest league position the club has ever recorded. For them, and me, the impossible dream has been achieved. For Only a Game, I'm Russell Crewe.
The Ebola outbreak that devastated West Africa last year left more than 11,000 people dead.
My name is Erickson Touré. I'm the Ebola survivor.
Erickson Touré of Sierra Leone is one of nearly 16,000 people who survived the virus. He has founded a soccer team made up of Ebola survivors. Video journalist Ben C. Solomon traveled across West Africa for 3 months last summer covering the outbreak for the New York Times, and he met Erickson at a hospital on the first day of filming.
We went to Kenema in the city he lived in, which was the heart of the outbreak at the time. The hospital was really under the worst stress for the outbreak, and they were just whizzing bodies by in kind of like lackluster body bags. It was really a dangerous place.
She is my mother.
And we met him because he had just been released a couple of days before, and he was reaching over the tarps to throw drinks and food to his mom, still in the Ebola ward.
So I'm only praying to God, bless my mother and my sister getting away.
Erickson says, I'm only praying to God, let my mother and my sister getting well. Nearly a year after that first meeting, Solomon returned to Sierra Leone to find out what had happened to Erickson.
When we found him, it was clear that he had lost a ton more family. He was one of eight brothers and sisters, and he had uncles and aunts and a big extended family. But of them, it was just him and his mother that made it. And the kids that didn't get sick, the kids of the Ebola victims, there were 15 left who are kind of staying with him and being taken care of by him.
When I go to the town, those who know me as a survivor, they will not even come to us with me.
When I go to the town, those who know me as a survivor, they will not even come close to me.
When we went back to see Erickson, he was depressed. He was really sad, kind of beaten down. But immediately, within 10 minutes of kind of catching up with him, he started talking about this soccer club and his like idea to create this all-survivor team who would defeat all the other teams and show everybody that the survivors are stronger than everybody thinks.
We need to help ourselves. So I make a football club.
In reality, these guys have a lot of health problems, and it's hard for them to play just as is. But a lot of the communities don't accept the survivors. A lot of the communities really stigmatize them and push them away. It's hard, Ebola as an outbreak, because there's no real person or face to put the blame on or to put the worry on. And for the survivors, I think they take a lot of the brunt of that anger and that frustration towards the outbreak. So this team kind of became a reasoning for him to kind of show that they can be real people too.
Solomon attended the team's first game, a match against the Ebola aid workers.
There is a lot of crowd.
If we gather here now for prevent the Ebola.
It was scaldingly hot, but it was packed. I mean, there was hundreds and hundreds of people. And I think the people, when they walked in, were very nervous and very curious to see what it was. I mean, I think people had heard bad things about survivors. They kind of worried about them. But as soon as the game was over, they were just as accepted in the community as they ever were. It was really a beautiful moment to see not only Erickson, but the whole team kind of embraced and welcomed back into this community and without the stigmas and the fears of this virus.
Although I did not win the game, those people want to touch me and to play with me.
Ben C. Solomon and his colleagues at the New York Times won the 2015 Pulitzer Prize for international reporting for their coverage of the Ebola outbreak. Solomon has since written that catching up with Erickson was one of the most important stories of our Ebola coverage.
I think that the Ebola outbreak was such a confusing and intense moment, and the coverage we did reflected that and showed kind of how crazy the situation on the ground was. It wasn't until the outbreak started to fade that really the long-term problems kind of set in. The stigma against these survivors, the economical difficulties of these towns that have been destroyed, these families that have lost entire extended families and don't know how to kind of support themselves. And I think that for me, it was just really important and really beautiful to be able to go back and find this really happy and kind of redemptive story. Just the fact that they're able to have this game is a real symbol that people are definitely starting to ease them back into the society and kind of accept them for what they have become.
You can link to Arison and the Ebola Soccer Survivors, directed by Ben C. Solomon, at onlyagame.org. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, Landon Donovan joins me to recap his stellar soccer career. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie, and congratulations on winning the Sydney Award, which recognizes journalists for writing about stuff even more important than sports. In this case, your Esquire piece on New Orleans 10 years after Hurricane Katrina. Well done.
Thank you. You're very kind. Okay, what's up?
Earlier this week, the world of pro football exploded because Don Van Natta and Seth Wickersham wrote about it. Have I got that about right?
Yeah, pretty much. It was a long and respectively detailed, if somewhat anonymous, account of all the way the New England Patriots have played fast and loose with the book of etiquette of National Football League franchises, including keeping the Gatorade too warm and apparently doing some advanced Gordon Liddy scouting, if you know what I mean, in various hotel rooms and visiting locker rooms. But I think the most interesting thing about it is that Bill Belichick has clearly rented a 5-room luxury condo in the heads of just about everybody else in the league.
The New England Patriots beat the Pittsburgh Steelers on Thursday night, so now we have headset gate, right?
Yeah, this is unbelievable. Just when you thought it couldn't get any weirder. Yeah, somehow the New England Patriots radio play-by-play got piped into the headsets of the Pittsburgh Steelers. Now, I'm somebody who believes that they shouldn't even have headsets.
Mm-hmm.
I think we should go back to letting quarterbacks call their own plays and letting coaches send in people if they want to change plays. I think quarterbacks should think on their feet more than they do.
NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell was quoted on Tuesday. He said, "We want to get a better discipline system." And then on Wednesday, he said that no changes in the NFL's discipline process are imminent. What?
Yeah, I don't know what he's doing at this point, neither does he. Something has to change. Otherwise, every player who they try to discipline for any reason is going to wind up with a cause of action.
The American Gaming Association, which represents the casino industry, estimated this week that of the $95 billion that will be wagered on pro football this year, $93 billion will be bet illegally. That's a fairly convincing argument for legal sports betting, I think. What do you think?
Well, I mean, it's certainly a fairly convincing argument that without gambling of one kind or another, there wouldn't be a National Football League. But that having been said, yeah, I think it's a pretty good argument that people, you know, that people should be able to profit from this industry above the table.
Charlie, Friday marked the 30th anniversary of Pete Rose's 4,192nd hit. That's when he passed Ty Cobb and established the all-time hits record. And so the Reds decided to honor Rose with a bobblehead for every fan attending Saturday's home game in Cincinnati. I'm imagining a Rob Manfred bobblehead doll nodding and bobbing in approval. What do you think?
I don't think so, no. Once again, the embarrassment that is Pete Rose continues apace. There's no getting away from the guy. He's stuck to the history of baseball like gum on a shoe.
On Thursday night, Mets starter Bartolo Colon pitched, fielded, and even batted his team to victory over the Braves, kept New York atop the NL East. But in doing so, he had his 31-inning scoreless streak stopped. Gee whiz, he's really slowing down at age 42.
It is remarkable, of course, because he looks like the kindly grocer from down the street at this point. Not only that, he looks like the kindly grocer's best customer at this point. There's a remarkable piece of video of him throwing a runner out behind his back after fielding a ground ball. Bartolo Colon is, among our athletes, one of the most remarkable.
This week, Wade Boggs superfan Richard Davis tweeted a picture of a baseball he was considering buying that had allegedly been signed by Wade Boggs, and Davis wondered if it was legitimate, and Boggs instantly responded with a tweet, one word, nope. Wade Boggs, Hall of Famer, contact hitter par excellence, and now memorabilia expert, at least regarding his own memorabilia.
Yeah, I don't know how he knew, but I would probably take his word for it, because Wade Boggs has an incredible series of very savant-like compulsions, and I think probably identifying every baseball he ever swung at is probably one of them.
We talked last week about the party coffin and the joys that it would surely bring to tailgaters who could pack all sorts of goodies into it. But Nick Saban's Mercedes dealership in Hoover, Alabama, is now offering a tailgating vehicle to die for. What is that?
It's a $200,000 Mercedes luxury van. It's probably the nicest car any football fan has ever thrown up on, to be perfectly honest with you. It has three TVs.
Mm-hmm.
It has a high-tech audio and video system and a cooler. It also has hardwood flooring, high-grain leather, and massage chairs.
Why would anybody get out of it and go to the game?
Why would anybody go to the game? Exactly. Why won't you just live in the car?
And finally, Charlie, fans of Mississippi State football had their eyes on a world record this week.
Guess what? I got a fever. And the only prescription is more cowbell.
I hadn't known that Christopher Walken was a Bulldogs fan. Anyway, on Thursday night in Starkville, the attempt to set this record sounded like this. That is the sound of 5,748 cowbells, and it was good enough for Guinness Book recognition. I don't know about you. I'm glad I wasn't there.
Yeah, the cowbells are sort of their fetish object during football games. I'm mostly startled by the fact that there was actually a record for ringing the cowbells to break.
So my next question was going to be, how long do you think the record will stand? But I think this is just preposterous.
Well, it'll stand at least until the next Mississippi State game.
You can find the sports writing of Sydney Award-winning writer Charlie Pierce at Grantland, and he joins me each week on Only a Game as well. Charlie, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Bill.
This week, at the urging of 19 lawmakers from 8 states, the NFL urged its teams to, quote, comply with federal and state wage laws when paying their cheerleaders. That edict won't necessarily result in NFL cheerleaders receiving fair pay. In most states, cheerleaders, no matter which sport they cheer for, are treated as independent contractors, except in California, where in July, Governor Jerry Brown signed a law declaring that cheerleaders must be treated as employees, thereby receiving at least minimum wage, overtime, and other benefits. As a former cheerleader for the Golden State Warriors, Lisa Murray has been part of the campaign for fairer pay for cheerleaders. Lisa, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you for having me.
Cheerleaders in California will now be paid $9 an hour, which certainly is not a lot. But tell me a little bit about what cheerleaders were getting paid before.
It can range. Some teams do not pay their dancers for practices or appearances. Some teams do pay minimum wage across the board for everything, whether it's a practice, a game, an appearance. But ultimately, when you crunch all the numbers, these women are making pennies for what they do.
People watching cheerleaders and dancers at pro sports might assume that it's a pretty glamorous life, but I'm gathering it's not easy to even make the rent if that's what you're doing.
You're right. I mean, cheerleading is considered to be high-status work and is extremely competitive and an athletic sport, and they're treated as low-skilled workers, but used as the high-value face of promotional and marketing campaigns and efforts. So unfortunately, these women are not making a living wage, which is what we're fighting for right now.
Was there a particular point when you were doing this work that you realized you weren't being compensated fairly for what they were asking you to do?
The moment I sat down and signed my contract my first year, it was very alarming. You think, I mean, I was paid $10 an hour for my first 2 years. It was $14 an hour your third year and $20 if you made captain. And you keep being told that you're making as much as you can.
Hmm.
And then when I found out about the lawsuit from a former teammate of mine, Lacey, who was actually on the Warriors team with me my first year, I started to do some research and I found out that what we're being told is not true. And the money we actually generate for these organizations far outweighs our compensation.
Along that line, I understand that you're now working with a professor at Southern Utah University trying to calculate how much cheerleaders and dancers for pro sports teams should be paid. How do you go about figuring that out?
We're gathering all information in terms of hours worked by all different teams. We're looking at TV time. This involves quantifying the hours worked and the compensation. We're also trying to ascertain the revenue the cheerleaders generate.
Mm-hmm.
And so ultimately, we wish to understand how large of a gap exists between the revenue the cheerleaders are generating and their hourly compensation.
Cheerleaders from five NFL teams have sued their employers. New York is considering a law like the one that was passed recently in California, but change seems to only be coming team by team and state by state. Could the NBA and the NFL have exercised more leadership with regard to cheerleader pay?
Absolutely. without a doubt. You know, but to be honest with you, it doesn't come as a surprise to me that they're fighting us in every which way. If you look at the history of the NFL and the NBA, ultimately players in the NBA, let's say, you know, made an average salary of about $8,000 per year before they formed a union.
Mm-hmm.
It's only a matter of time before we adjust the system. Ultimately, a lot of these teams are breaking the law by misclassifying these women as independent contractors. If you're not a direct employee, you do not have the right to organize. They're going to push back as much as they can, but it's only a matter of time before we will be classified as employees instead of independent contractors.
Lisa Murray is a former cheerleader for the Golden State Warriors and is supporting the national push for cheerleaders' rights. Lisa, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you so much for having me. Appreciate it.
On Tuesday, Landon Donovan, arguably the best soccer player the U.S. has produced, visited the Only a Game studios. He and his companions were wearing blue polo shirts with a logo of Liberty Mutual Insurance, known for its long sponsorship of the U.S. Olympic team and, more recently, U.S. soccer.
I started working with them earlier this year. We went to the U.S.-Mexico game in San Antonio, and it's really just been a fun way for me to stay connected to the game, to come in and do enjoyable things, fun things, like a fan.
Donovan recently retired from soccer, and he says he's still getting used to that idea. He has more goals and assists than anyone who's played for the U.S. men's national team, but he got the first 7 goals of his career during his very first organized game. He was 5 years old. That's the age at which Donovan picks up his story in his own words.
My life as a child revolved around soccer. My older brother wanted me to play. He liked it, and so he got me into it early, and I fell in love with it. Eventually, I was playing with the youth national team, and I got scouted by a team in Germany. And next thing I knew, I was signing a contract and moving to Germany just after my 17th birthday. I knew nothing about the team, the league, the city, the country, nothing. And I went, unfortunately, we didn't have the ability for anybody to go with me. So I went by myself, which at 17 was a little scary, but also very exciting to have this freedom. I could eat cereal for dinner if I wanted. I could wake up and go to sleep whenever I wanted. So it was great. But it was culturally very shocking. A kid from Southern California who now moved to pretty cold and dreary part of West Germany. One story that I remember vividly is I went to the grocery store one of the first days I was there, and I got my groceries, and the checker was checking the groceries through, and I went down a little ramp, and I was sort of standing there after I had paid, and she was looking at me, and I was looking at her, and I was waiting for the groceries to get bagged, and she kept looking at me, and I heard people behind me in line going, "Ugh, ugh, like, what is he doing?" And I realized for the first time that you bag your own groceries there, and I had no idea. So little things like that, which probably played into their stereotype of me being a spoiled American, didn't help much, and so it was things like that that made you realize quickly that you weren't in Southern California anymore.
Starke Flanke, starker Abschluss. So geht das, wenn man verpflichtet werden möchte. Wieder Landon Donovan.
Major League Soccer was only a few years old, and it didn't have the cachet that it now carries. And so MLS was not really on my radar in that way, which is crazy to say because now kids grow up watching us. But for me, I didn't have that. So only a few years after I went to Germany and I wasn't playing much and sort of missing home, did I then really start looking at MLS as a real option, and thankfully I did.
Landon, classy.
Landon, yes!
I was with the Galaxy, and our coach at the time, Frank Yallop, came to me one day. I was the captain, and we would have these conversations sometimes about, you know, we're looking at this player or that player to bring in, and he said, "What do you think about David Beckham?" And I said, well, he's a great player. Why? And he said, "Well, we may have a chance to sign him." And I said, "You're crazy. There's no chance David Beckham's coming here. That's ridiculous." And sure enough, next thing you knew, we were having a press conference with the David Beckham signing for the LA Galaxy.
Ladies and gentlemen, it is my distinct pleasure and honor to introduce to Los Angeles and the world
The newest member of the LA Galaxy, Mr. David Beckham.
With that came this great spotlight and this great platform for everybody to perform, to show their personalities, to showcase themselves. And so it was terrific for all of us. Times have changed drastically. When I started in 2001 in Major League Soccer, you had a few guys coming over from Europe, a few top name guys coming over. But they were 35, 36, 37 years old, and they had nothing left in the tank. And so they were coming over for a vacation and to make some money and play a few games, but they weren't vested in the league. They didn't care about what happened. They didn't care about the outcome. And now when I look at this year, you've got a guy who's probably the leading MVP candidate, Sebastian Giovinco, who plays in Toronto, who's 27 years old. Regularly called into the Italian national team now, one of the best national teams in the world, while playing in Major League Soccer. You've got Robbie Keane, who's the all-time leading scorer for Ireland and the captain of Ireland, who plays for the Galaxy now. And you have this influx of players like this that are playing in our league now. And not only that, it used to be that every American that came through the ranks immediately wanted to go to Europe. And now it's changing. Guys are saying, well, I can make good money in America. I can play at a high level in America. I think when we look back on it historically, you'll say this was a tipping point where things really changed for Major League Soccer.
Landon Donovan is a former star for the U.S. men's national team and Major League Soccer. Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Martin Kessler. Our technical director is James Trout, with lots of help this week from Marquise Neal, Zoe Sobel, and Rebecca Sinanis. Our interns are Sean Gannon and Alex Schroeder. We bid a fond adieu this week to former intern and current infielder for the Emerson College baseball team, Joe Jacobs. Keep turning those double plays, Joe. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. Our final word comes from Pittsburgh Steelers head coach Mike Tomlin. Sorry, Mike. Something going on in the headphones. Not sure what's going on there. I'll have to get back to you. I'm Bill Littlefield. I'll be back next week with more sports, NPR style, on Only a Game. And thank you for listening.